For 2 decades after he played in Eau Claire, Henry Aaron was just another in a long line of successful major leaguers that the city called his own. Then, in 1974, he broke Babe Ruth's home run record. Aaron became a hero to the nation. Everyone in the world was talking about him. Presidents Nixon and Ford, comedian Flip Wilson, civil rights activists Jesse Jackson and Andrew Young, Sammy Davis Jr., and even the baseball-loving Japanese. Muhammad Ali proclaimed in his best raspy voice that Aaron was the greatest. Aaron became much bigger even than baseball, a symbol of American success, a symbol of black success, and unfortunately at times a symbol of America's slow progress in race relations. The story of Aaron's breaking the record was as much about the racist hate mail he received as it was about his achievement, as much about being black as it was about being successful.
Henry Aaron came to baseball at a time when the sport and the country were changing rapidly. What about Aaron and the times turned him into one of the game's great players? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
How did a young black player from segregated Mobile, Alabama, come to terms with Eau Claire, Wisconsin, a town that had only 7 black residents? In what way did baseball in Eau Claire represent baseball in America? What propelled Aaron from the Negro League to the minor leagues to a World Series win with the Milwaukee Braves? And what was the significance of his beating Babe Ruth's home run record? For that matter, what's the significance of Barry Bonds beating Hank Aaron's record with home run number 756? Our guest is Jerry Poling, an editor and columnist with the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram and author of A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron and the Legend of Eau Claire Baseball, published by the University of Wisconsin Press in 2002.
And thanks for joining us for University of the Air.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, when you heard the news about Barry Bonds breaking the record, as someone who had written about Hank Aaron, how did that make you feel?
A little bit sad in a way. I'm a big fan of Henry Aaron's, so to see his record broken, a little disappointed in a way because I like Henry and all that he stood for throughout his career. And you always think of him as being the greatest, kind of like Muhammad Ali. And when you see one of your heroes no longer considered the greatest, even though he's still one of the greatest, so it bugs you a little bit, I guess. But I think sports fans are realists, and certainly I'm one too, that pretty much any record that stands in any sport is going to be broken at some point.
Well, so, and couldn't you argue that by having the record broken, but with sort of controversy around it, that it has also called attention to what it was that Henry Aaron offered that Barry Bonds does not?
Well, there's no question about that. And I've talked with a lot of people about that in the last couple of months, about how Henry stood for so many good things, including the symbol of hard work and rising up from nothing to become someone special and someone that people admire in this country. And that sort of is, I mean, it's brought out, right? It's brought out in this whole home run chase that Henry is a special person, I believe. And I think he is different than Barry Bonds in a lot of ways, and I think that makes the home run chase a little bit bittersweet in a way. Barry is the type of guy that is a little harder to get behind and love as much as Henry Aaron, I think. So in that regard, it's fun talking about Henry and what he accomplished, and I think he's gotten a lot of attention out of this. So I think that's been a good thing, too, to realize what great things he did do with his career.
Henry Aaron wasn't the first black in Major League Baseball, but he was one of the first, and he certainly came out of a system that was fully segregated when he was quite young. Mobile, Alabama. However, he did not play baseball in high school, as so many did. How did he develop as a young man and as a ball player in those early years?
Well, he played, I think, like most kids in America, started playing baseball, at least back in the 40s and 50s. He grew up listening to radio, games on the radio, and started playing sandlot ball in his neighborhood, and found that he not only loved it, but he had certainly a talent for it. And then started playing with a semi-pro town team in Mobile, and eventually got noticed by one of the Indianapolis Clown Scouts.
You've got to explain that name first. I mean, this is not the name that you'd expect for a baseball team today, the Indianapolis Clowns.
Right. They're a Negro League team, and basically they They were sort of a barnstorming team with a history like the Harlem Globetrotters. They went around and not only played very good baseball, but they entertained fans as well with clowning around shtick and doing a variety of things. They had a player with a giant glove, and they had a player who was ambidextrous, and they had a guy who pitched from a rocking chair, and just a variety of things to just entertain fans and get fans in the stands. And again, they were a black team. It was a Negro League team, and that was Henry's first team. His first real team as a professional, getting signed to play for the Indianapolis Clowns in early 1952.
And this would have been for black spectators?
That's right. Henry grew up, of course, in a segregated area of Mobile, and when he started playing baseball for the Indianapolis Clowns, he was still in a completely segregated situation. Even though he was suddenly traveling around the country at age 18 in early 1952, he still was playing in front of black crowds and with black teammates and not really in an integrated environment.
You write in your book, you quote Henry Aaron saying that without Jackie Robinson, there would be no Henry Aaron. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, Henry, a couple times when I talked to him for the book, he explained that when he would have been, I believe, 12 or 13 years old, I think, when Jackie Robinson broke into the majors. And, Henry and his dad and the kids in his neighborhood, that was such a big deal to them to have a black player in the major leagues. And Henry, even at 13, that was his dream to be a major leaguer. He suddenly knew that he had a chance to be a major leaguer now. It wasn't just a pipe dream that, hey, someday I could play, but blacks can't play. No, now all of a sudden blacks could play in the majors, and he knew that there was a chance. And so it meant the world to him to see Jackie Robinson there. And I think not only to kids who wanted to play in the majors, but just black people in general. All of a sudden they were a bigger part of mainstream society in America.
Was it Jackie Robinson? Let's say he came into the majors when in 1947?
That's right.
Is that what really led pretty quickly to the demise of the Negro Leagues, I think, the next year?
Yeah, definitely. I think the Negro Leagues struggle on for another 10 years even, but as soon as the star players like Mays and Aaron and Larry Doby and some of these, and even Satchel Paige, some of these great Negro League players started getting plucked from the Negro Leagues to play in the major leagues, blacks started going to the major league games to see their stars in the major leagues, and the Negro League attendance dwindled, and of course the talent was starting to dwindle. So, yeah, the Negro Leagues were on their downside even in 52 when Henry played for the Clowns and then eventually, of course, moved on to the major leagues.
Is there anything important to know about his family life before he sort of became such a baseball figure?
Well, I think so. He came from a family that was close-knit. I'm not sure how many kids were in the family, but it was, it seems to me, like 6 or 8 children. His mother was a hardworking homemaker, and his dad worked in the shipyards in Mobile area. And it was a family with a real strong work ethic. And I think Henry knew and grew up with the feeling that you worked hard to get somewhere in life. And it was one of his dreams, I think, to put everything he had into baseball to get somewhere. If it had been something else, if Henry Aaron had a talent for something else, I certainly believe he would have been successful, because I think he had a good example and a work ethic from his parents, and knew that he had to work hard to get somewhere in life and realize that he was coming from nothing, and to get somewhere, it was going to require a huge effort on his part in life in general.
What was the relationship in 1951 or 52? What was the relationship between the minor leagues and the major leagues?
It was a pretty strong one. I mean, minor league baseball back then was outstanding, because major league baseball was getting all the best athletes in the country. Pro football, pro basketball, other sports just were not the marquee sports that they are today. Baseball still got the best athletes in the country, and they all got signed by the major league teams if they were anybody growing up in their little towns. And so the minor leagues were very strong, and there were teams all over the country, especially in the northern half of the country. It seems to me like there were more teams, but just very strong relationships. Teams had sometimes 10, 12, 13 minor league teams spread around the country. The Milwaukee Braves or Boston Braves, for example, had 3 Class A teams. Now teams have just 1 Class A team. But there were just dozens of great young athletes all around the country hoping to get a shot to play in the majors. And the major league teams supported the minor league teams with money and with training and supplied them with coaches. And there really was a strong, close relationship from the majors to the minors.
And how did Henry Aaron get from the Clowns then all the way up to Eau Claire?
Well, he was playing, of course, with the Clowns in February, March, April, May, and in, I believe he started, I'm not sure what month it was, but it's somewhere in that spring as the Clowns were traveling in the southeast. Henry's batting average went up over 400, and some of the scouts for the major league teams, of course, were looking at these Negro League teams to try and find some talent, and they'd heard that Henry's batting average was outstanding. Of course, he was only 18, and that made a difference in the Negro Leagues because a lot of the Negro League players were 25, 30 years old at that point, and the scouts weren't looking for somebody like that. They were looking for somebody like a Willie Mays or Henry Aaron, who was 18, 19, and looked to be an outstanding talent.
So they could hang on to for 10 or 12 years.
Right, right. So he was batting up over 400 early in the season, and scouts from several major league teams came to see him. But in late May, the Boston Braves, then a scout named Dewey Griggs, approached him and said they were interested in him, and actually noticed that Henry was batting cross-handed at that point because Henry had no baseball instruction in his life. He just was relying on pure natural God-given ability. And in late May, then they actually tried to sign him and ended up with a little bit of a signing battle with the New York Giants. Of course, at that time, also had Willie Mays in their system. But the Braves went out in a somewhat of a heated battle to get Henry and sign him to a contract in late May, and then assigned him to their Class C team in the Northern League, which is Eau Claire, and told him to report there in early June.
And that must have been quite a culture shock.
I think so. Well, the first culture shock for Henry was he had to take a plane ride from Chicago to Eau Claire, and he'd never been on a plane in his life. And so he had to get through that first. And then you can imagine, of course, he's flying not only in a plane for the first time, but he's flying farther north than he's ever been in his life. And now he's landing in a city like Eau Claire that he knows nothing about. And he's never been that far away from home. He realizes once he lands that it's not a big city, about 35,000 at that time. And when he gets here, he realizes there's virtually no black people here, except for a couple of teammates. And he's going to be playing on a white team for the first time. So the culture shock was coming at him from every angle. I think that had to be a very difficult time in his life to walk off that plane that far away from home in a city that was completely foreign to him.
Where was he living?
That was an interesting story because that day he was picked up by the sports editor of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, who was the official scorekeeper for the Northern League and also at that time helped some of the players find housing. And this one person, his name was Claude Buzzel, met Henry at the airport and drove him at that point down to the YMCA where Henry was going to stay for the summer. Now, the interesting thing about that was a lot of the players stayed in homes of host parents in Eau Claire that year. So I don't know exactly what happened at that point because Henry, I don't know if the host parents had all been taken and the only place left was the YMCA, but Henry ended up at the YMCA, so he was in a little bit of a segregated environment again in that the three black players on the team that year all stayed at the YMCA, along with a couple of white players. So they didn't get a chance to quite blend in with the community quite the way some of the other players did. But the YMCA in Eau Claire was really a nice place. It had rooms for a dollar a night, and it was kind of a hangout of athletes, so Henry felt really comfortable there, and he really said it was one of the best rooms he'd ever had in his life. When he looks back, he said just because it was a kind of a sanctuary for him. He had, for the first time in his life, he had a room for the summer. He said he got two towels a day, and he thought that was outstanding. Other athletes were hanging around. There was a pool there. He was right near downtown, about a mile from the ballpark, and he could walk to the ballpark with his friends and teammates. You know, it's a good spot for him because it was kind of a sandstone building. It was just a nice, solid building. I think he felt kind of at home there for the summer.
Can you describe his personality at that point? It sounds to me from reading your book as if he was quite shy and lonely at times.
Yeah, and that is generally, from what I have seen of Henry, that's still generally his personality. He's not a real outgoing, bubbly personality. He tends to be sort of reserved. But you can imagine back in 1952 at age 18 in Eau Claire, in this foreign culture almost, he was really shy and really quiet. I know there were some people I talked to who knew him back at that time and said, he really said very, very little early on in the summer and just kept to himself almost completely. In fact, the day he was picked up at the airport and that Mr. Buzzel brought him to the YMCA, Mr. Buzzel actually stopped at his own home at that point to introduce him to his wife. And when Aaron walked into the Buzzel's house, it was the first time in his life he'd been in the home of a white person. And Mrs. Buzzel said that when Aaron walked through the door, he actually was shaking. He was scared. It was just such a foreign situation to him.
What kind of contract did he have?
It actually wasn't too bad at that time. He made $350 a month. And at that time, that was actually better than the average manufacturing wage in Wisconsin, and I believe in Eau Claire. Not a lot of money by today's standards, of course, but at that time, that was like a windfall to him. playing for the Clowns. I can't remember what he made, but it wasn't very much. It might have been $10 a game or $20 a game, something like
How
that.
How was the job security?
Not very good, of course. You know, the contract says you're not playing well, the team at any point has the right to cut you. So Henry knew once he got there, and he knew baseball well enough at that point to know if you don't perform, you're gone. So he knew that, you know, he could be in Eau Claire for 3 months or maybe 3 weeks. If he didn't get a hit, they'd probably send him back to the Clowns.
You quote him as writing, "Some of the whitest states in the union gave a young black man reason to keep dreaming." What were his dreams at that point? Was it mostly for the sake of the sport? Did he long for fame? What were his dreams?
Well, I think his initial dream was to just be a great baseball player. I think he knew he had talent to be an outstanding player. He had that natural hitting ability, and he had good speed. He had all the tools to really be a good baseball player. But, you know, I think coming from where he did, I think his dream was greater than that. I think it was a chance to see America in a different way than he saw it in the South. I think he probably knew that there were parts of America where he could walk around and not worry about who he was talking to and where he was going. And I think really that was his larger dream. And you know, I think he saw a glimpse of that summer in 52. By the middle of the summer in Eau Claire, he was walking around downtown and going to restaurants and socializing with young white women and not being afraid of it. And he saw that all over the upper Midwest, I think, that summer. Not that it was easy, or not that he still wasn't, you know, a little bit leery of what he couldn't do, but I think he started to get a glimpse of America that was a little different than the one he grew up in Mobile.
But you write that he still had to hide when some young white men came and followed them.
Yeah, the one incident I think that sort of seared in Henry's memory from that summer, in fact, in 1994, when he came back to Eau Claire to unveil the statue of him, he asked about this particular incident because he remembered it so well. And what happened was Henry and this young woman that he knew, Susan, and a couple of other friends went up to a lookout about 12 miles away from Eau Claire in a city called Elk Mound. And they were up there in the evening, just enjoying the view, and they saw another car approaching, and the women in the group, Susan and her friends, knew that this car belonged to some of the white boys in town who were their friends. And they suspected that the white boys were a little upset that they were hanging around with Henry and Wes and were a little bit jealous, and they thought there could be some trouble. So they told Henry and Wes to hide in the bushes because they didn't want a fight to break out. So Henry and Wes did. They jumped in the bushes, and these guys came up and saw the girls and didn't see the players, and the whole situation was sort of diffused, and the guys left. And Henry and Wes jumped out of the bushes, and they enjoyed the rest of the evening. So, wait, was there tension there? Yeah, there was tension the whole summer. But I think he was testing his limits a little bit, where in Mobile, he knew what his limits were by the Jim Crow laws. But in Eau Claire, I think it was sort of an open-ended deal to some degree, and he could explore a little bit and see a little different side of America and a little bit of different, you know, explore his life a little bit and see who he wanted to be.
What was the status of the integration of professional sports at this point in the country? Is this a story that was likely being repeated through many small towns in the North?
Yeah, this was going on in every minor league town in the country. And what you have to remember is that, you know, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. And so people tend to think, okay, well, the color barrier is broken, it's all over. Well, that was really just the start of it, because it was about another 10 years before every team in the major league had a black player. Some teams, it took a decade to get their first black player. And, of course, in the minor league towns, then that was reverberated throughout all the minor league towns. Each minor league town then started breaking the color barrier, and so they had to go through it in all these towns across the country. But more importantly, each player who went to one of these cities was breaking the color barrier himself for the first time. And so that's what really was the impact, is each person had to go through this and play in a city where maybe there hadn't been blacks before. And Henry was, even though there had been blacks in Eau Claire playing for 2 years prior to Henry, Henry had never been to a white city and played in that environment before. So was it as tough as Jackie Robinson or some of the players who broke color barriers? No, but it still was hard on a person like Henry who was coming out of the South and didn't know what to expect.
How did his teammates feel? Was there a sense that maybe he was depriving some white player of a job ever?
I don't remember hearing that from the other, you know, the white teammates that I interviewed for the book. I think there was seemed to be no real racial tension on the team that I was aware of. And, you know, I've heard that in other teams and in other sports, that there was that issue raised among teammates, and certainly that was one of the issues with Jackie Robinson and the Brooklyn Dodgers. But I didn't get that sense that it was an issue in Eau Claire. I think blacks had been around in baseball at that point for 5 years, and I think white players accepted that fact that they were going to be there, and it was everybody was simply competing to be the best on the team, and everybody wanted to get to the majors, and it didn't make any difference at that point whether you're black or white, because everybody had the same chance, I think.
We're going to trace the story of Henry Aaron and his rise to stardom when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Jerry Poling, and we're talking about the last guy to break a home run record. That was 33 years ago. More about that later, but his name, and he is one of those living legends of baseball, Henry Aaron, also known as Hank Aaron. We've followed the 18-year-old Henry Aaron to Eau Claire, where he's playing for the minor league team, the Eau Claire Bears. How did the season work for him? He's been seen as a power hitter hitherto, but once he gets to Eau Claire in this new context, playing in front of white people, how is it different?
It didn't seem to be of any worry to Henry that he was playing in front of white people, other than the fact he might have been a little nervous early on, but he certainly didn't show it in the way he played. His first time at bat, there was a man on second base, Chet Morgan, and I'm not sure if it was the first pitch or second pitch, but Henry, one of the first few pitches he saw from a white player in his life, he lined over the shortstop's head into left field and got an RBI single, and I think he also had another hit that night as well. So he got off to a great start, and it just continued from there. He was such a good natural hitter that, well, within a little over a month, he was named to the Northern League All-Star team. And by the end of the summer, he was in the batting race for the Northern League batting championship. Actually, he was leading the league in hitting for much of the summer, and then in the last few weeks, faded a little bit and ended up finishing second in the batting race, but still hit an outstanding .336 for the summer.
You write in your book about the size of his wrist.
There was one man that who had seen Henry Aaron up close that summer, and he was kind of a baseball junkie in Eau Claire, 15-year-old kid, and he remembers he helped drag the field before games, and he would always try to get up close to the players and chat with them, and he said one day he was standing next to Henry talking to him and looked at his wrists and said, "My God, his wrists were huge." And he said, "I'd never seen anything like it." And I thought he was, you know, just being a wide-eyed kid and remembering the story, exaggerating this tale a little bit, but and I did a little research, and I ran across an article that said the circumference of Henry's wrists actually at that time were larger than the circumference of the heavyweight boxing champion at that time. I think it was Joe Louis. I'm not sure. But you get a sense that this guy had some natural talent that went beyond the ordinary. And certainly the wrists were one of the keys to the way Henry hit. He tended to hit off the front foot and flicked his wrists at the last second to get a lot of his power. And that's why he hit a lot of line drives, and that's why his batting average was really higher than a lot of home run hitters. He didn't necessarily hit soaring, towering home runs. He would just hit a lot of what they call in baseball frozen ropes, line shots that often would just carry over the wall or bounce off the wall or go to the gap for doubles and triples.
When did he hit that first home run for the Bears? Was it a memorable occasion?
It was on the road, and it was in Fargo, North Dakota. So in my mind, it was a memorable occasion because one of the people living in Fargo, North Dakota at that time was Roger Maris. And Roger Maris was 1 year younger than Henry Aaron. Actually born the same year, but about a year, almost a year younger. Both born in 1934. I don't know if Roger Maris was in the stands that night, but he certainly was around town at that point. He had just graduated from high school. So Henry hit his first home run off a pitcher named Reuben Stoes for Fargo Moorhead. And was Roger Maris there? I don't know. But Roger Maris the next year played in the Northern League just like Henry Aaron. And, of course, Roger and Henry were the two players who went on to break Babe Ruth's most famous home run records, the single-season home run record and the career home run record. So, to me, that was a memorable place where he hit that first home run. Pretty amazing to me that those two players who broke those amazing records came out of the same league within a year of each other.
When did Henry Aaron start being called Hank? And how did I notice all the way through the book you call him Henry Aaron, and I've always heard him referred to more as Hank Aaron.
I'm trying to remember exactly how he got the nickname Hank, but I remember there was a player for the Chicago Cubs named Hank Sauer, and they called him Hammer and Hank. And I think somewhere along the line, because of the Henry name and the Hank name, Henry picked up that same name. And I think it was largely because of the way he hit the ball as well. He kind of hammered it. He hit these line drives just like pounding a hammer, like pounding a nail. He just slammed them. And it sort of fit for Henry. Even though he wasn't a big home run hitter early in his career, just the way he hit the ball was a sort of hammering style. in it. And it was kind of a pickup off of the, again, he wasn't the first Hammer and Hank. Hammer and Hank Sauer from the Cubs was the original Hammer and Hank. But it really fit the way he hit the ball. I remember one story once about the way Henry hit a home run was he'd lined it at the shortstop, and the shortstop jumped up to try and catch it. And the shortstop turned around and saw the ball go out of the ballpark for a home run. Now, you almost never see that because a ball hit that low generally isn't going to carry out. But Henry hit the ball so hard and so it's a line drive fashion that this shortstop actually thought he had a chance to catch it at first.
Is he starting to get noticed by the press at this point while he's still playing for the Bears?
Did the local press, probably. Certainly there were a few stories in the local newspaper about him, but I think more importantly, he was getting noticed by, and around the Northern League, you know, teams like St. Cloud and Fargo, Superior and Duluth. I found clippings about him, that he was this all-star player and supposedly a phenom that was, you know, who was going to make it to the majors. So I think within the Northern League, yes, he was one of the players that people were coming out to see because they knew he was expected to be a great player. But more importantly, I think the people in the Boston Braves organization that year, they had pegged him as being one of their potentially great players down the line. And they would call Eau Claire virtually every night and say, what was Aaron's statistic tonight? How did he hit? Because they were following him very closely. And they actually told the coach of Eau Claire, Bill Adair, coincidentally, who was from Mobile, Alabama, they told Bill Adair to not do anything with Henry Aaron's hitting style, just to leave him alone because he was such a great natural hitter. They did not want in any way to mess up the way Henry hit.
So did he always hit cross-handed?
Well, no, when this Braves scout saw him in May, he actually corrected him. And so Henry was not hitting cross-handed by the time he got to Eau Claire. That was his first piece of instruction that I'm aware of, outside of maybe some of the clown's instruction that was given to him, which probably wasn't much.
I don't remember the player's name, but you write about somebody being injured in the ear, I think, and sort of permanently had a career shortened because of that incredible hit.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about Henry hitting cross-handed and doing things in an unorthodox way without any training. Well, certainly the way he threw was also unorthodox. And in fact, one of the people who had played in the minor leagues and was living in Eau Claire at that time, a man named Diz Cronenberg, a friend of mine, remembers watching Henry that summer and saying he didn't think Henry would make it to the majors. And one of the main reasons is because Henry threw the ball in such an unorthodox way. He threw it side-armed. And you don't see that in any major league player today. The normal way throwing motion for a fielder is to raise the ball up over their head and just, you know, throw it overhand to whatever base or whatever person they're throwing it to. Well, Henry threw it sort of side-armed or underarmed. And you never see that with an infielder now. But nobody had ever told him that was the wrong way to do it. Well, when he was, I think, a couple weeks into the season in Eau Claire, he was playing shortstop and had gone to second base to try and complete a double play. The ball was hit to second. Henry went to second to cover the base, step on the bag, and then throw to first for the double play. While being this underarm thrower, the guy who was running from first to second was a man named Chuck Wiles, who was playing for Superior, a guy who had potential major league ability. And Henry Aaron's sidearm throw, of course, came off his hand real low instead of high, and it came off right about head level with Chuck Wiles and hit him right in the ear, or right behind the ear, and knocked Wiles unconscious. And Wiles ended up in the hospital. And to make a long story short, never played baseball again. I mean, he tried, but he simply couldn't. The throw that had hit by Aaron, that had hit Wiles, had killed Wiles' inner ear and had destroyed his equilibrium. So Wiles actually never even held a full-time job in his career after that.
You write that Hank Aaron never apologized for that. That seemed odd to me.
I know Chuck Wiles said he kept at times trying to make contact with Aaron and ask for not necessarily ask for an apology, but maybe just to tell Aaron, you know, that he was okay with it. It was just part of baseball, and he had trouble getting a hold of Aaron. I don't know if Aaron maybe didn't know who Chuck Wiles was, maybe never knew his name or had forgotten it, or maybe was just wanted to avoid the whole incident. But apparently they never actually connected after that. But I do know Henry was very upset about it, and I know in his heart he was apologetic. He felt really bad about it because it was just a couple of weeks after that, or maybe within a few days, he actually thought about quitting the team and heading home. And one of the reasons was because he felt like he had nearly killed Chuck Wiles, and adding to the fact he was pretty lonely early on in Eau Claire and you know, still not comfortable at all with the environment, being stared at and being in this white culture that he wasn't used to. You know, throwing all those things in the mix, he actually called home at one point to his parents in Mobile and said he wanted to quit. And I do think the hitting Chuck Wiles was really weighing heavy on his heart.
What changed his mind?
Well, that phone call actually changed his mind. His mother tried to convince him that, you know, this was his chance to do something to realize his dream to play baseball and he shouldn't give it up. He still wasn't convinced, and one of his brothers got on the phone and, you know, lit into him and said, "Henry, are you crazy? You know, this is, you know, you've got a chance to go someplace from Eau Claire. I mean, that's just the start. You can go a lot of places if you play well in Eau Claire, and this is your dream. Don't quit. You're crazy. What's back here in Mobile?" He kept telling Henry, "There's nothing back here. You know, where you are, you've got a chance to do something valuable in your life and realize your dream." So they gave him a pep talk, basically, and Henry was calling from the YMCA in Eau Claire and was, you know, to make a long-distance call, which at that time, you know, wasn't cheap, and he didn't have a lot of money.
Pumping a lot of change into the phone.
Yeah, so you knew he was actually serious about it, to call home and say, "Hey, this is, I'm heading home." But they talked him out of it. And in fact, I also talked to a couple of Duluth players at that time who had met Henry for breakfast one morning in one of the restaurants downtown. And he had told these Duluth players the same thing. He said, "I'm quitting, you know. I just about killed this Chuck Wiles last week, and I feel terrible. I'm not comfortable here. I'm going to quit." And they said, "You're crazy, Henry. You got great talent. You know, you're a great hitter. Just stay with it. A lot of us are, you know, lonely, and a lot of us struggle with things. But this is the minor leagues. You just got to get through it."
Did he change his throw?
I don't think he did that year. He ended up, interestingly enough, he ended up having a lot of errors that year, and primarily because of that throwing motion was not the best motion, and he had like 30 errors or something, and it was really, really a lot of them. He ended up, of course, playing in the outfield in his career, and he said later on in his career that he never did like playing the infield with the idea of a runner bearing down on him as he was trying to throw the ball to first. So he mentally, that Chuck Wiles play kind of stuck with him for a long time. You know, he just was more comfortable in the outfield after that Chuck Wiles play.
What sort of racism did he run into in Eau Claire, either overtly or subtly, that contributed to his feeling not so comfortable there, all aside from the having to stay at the Y while the white players stayed elsewhere?
Well, certainly there was racism in the fact that it was not necessarily spoken racism. You know, he said one time he walked out of the stadium in Eau Claire and saw a white man leaning against a car and just staring at Henry for a long time. And then that made him feel uncomfortable. He didn't know what that man was staring at him for, or if it was just because he was black or because he was a ball player. But, you know, the fact that you were black in Eau Claire, you got stared at because maybe it was assumed you were a ball player. Well, that might not have been racism, but it certainly made a guy like Henry feel uncomfortable to be stared at. You know, in his home and the segregated section of Mobile, of course, you never got any of that. So it was that feeling that you were in a fishbowl, I think, was hard for a guy like Henry and some of the other black players on the team. And there was some out-and-out racism, I think, too. Henry said he never was refused service at a restaurant in Eau Claire. I believe it did happen a couple of times on the road, but I was never able to confirm that. So some of the other towns they went to, they actually stayed at different hotels than they were planning to stay at because the original hotel wouldn't accept black players.
So they actually had to make an effort to find integrated hotels. I mean,
yes.
The same kind of thing that bands, musicians were encountering at that same time and previously.
Yeah, so it was there. I mean, the racism was there. I've heard people say that there some of the black players were called names in Eau Claire, but I asked Henry about that, and I've talked to other people, and I never got the sense that if there was any name-calling, it was much of anything. It was probably very subtle and not much. In general, Henry said the people at Eau Claire were really very good to him, and he said they treated him like just any other ball player. They looked at him basically as just another person and tried to treat him fairly, and that's what he had liked about Eau Claire after he left. And when he looked back at his experience, he said generally it was a good experience because people accepted him.
And how aware was he of sort of the growing civil rights movement? It's getting close to Brown versus Board of Education, lots happening in the South. How aware of all that was he?
I mean, I can't speak for him exactly, but I think he certainly had a sense for what was going on because, you know, he knew what it was like playing for the Clowns, and now he comes to Eau Claire and he's seen this different side of American life that he hadn't really seen before, and he knows what's out there. And what really drove home that point was that fall when he finished his season with Eau Claire, the Indianapolis Clowns called him and said, "Henry, you want to play with us again this fall? We're in the Negro League World Series," even though it was a sort of watered-down event. It wasn't really another barnstorming tour of the South, basically, against the other Negro League champion team. But when he went back to play with the Clowns that fall, he went back into segregation and saw a lot more racism again. He went back to the South. And then it really started to hit home with him that, wow, Eau Claire and the northern part of the country are quite a bit different from here again. And he actually said he was saddened to go back into that again because he had left it. And I think he, in his mind, maybe had left it behind. And now he's back in it again in the fall. So I think he was very well aware of that there were two different Americas out there. And he saw the one that I think he was striving for was the one that he saw in Eau Claire.
He spent just that one summer in Eau Claire?
Yes, summer in Eau Claire, yeah.
And just to summarize that whole experience for him personally and professionally, what was the product of that summer in Eau Claire?
Well, I think most people can look back on their life and say at some point they grew up. And you know, there's a sort of seminal moment or month or year in their life. And I think that was it for Henry Aaron. You know, there were tons of great things that happened to Henry after 1952, but I think if there's the one point where he went from a boy to a man, it was probably May, June, and July of 1952 when his whole world changed. You know, he went from this 18-year-old, underfed, still not physically mature kid to, by the fall, somebody who realized that he not only had talent to play professional baseball and probably would at some point, but somebody who had seen a different side of America and knew he could live on his own and get through things, you know. And that's really the big thing, I think, when you're a young person, is you all of a sudden realize, I can make it on my own. I've got the strength to go where I want to go, and I've got the determination. And I think after that summer, you know, all of those things had sort of gelled for him, and he knew where he was headed, and he was confident he could get there.
We'll follow Henry Aaron to the major leagues and to that home run record right after this. You're listening to University of the Air on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Henry Aaron was one of the most disciplined athletes, mentally and physically, I ever knew. He also is one of the greatest people I have ever had the good fortune to know. A summer up north will help you appreciate why. That's from the foreword by Bud Selig to the book A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron and the Legend of Eau Claire Baseball. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is the author of the book, Jerry Poling. We've followed him through the summer in Eau Claire, his growth, you say, from a young 18-year-old into someone aware of adulthood and the larger world outside. Can you now take Henry Aaron into the major leagues and tell us about his rise to fame?
Well, after he left Eau Claire, of course, played for the Indianapolis Clowns the fall of 52, and then 1953, the Braves moved him up to the league in Jacksonville, Florida, commonly known as the Sally League. And that was another huge summer for Henry Aaron for two reasons. One, he actually had a much harder season there in a racial sense than he did in Eau Claire, because in the Sally League, Henry and other players in that league were breaking the color barrier in that league. And of course, now we're in the South, so it was much more overt racism in Jacksonville and around that league than he experienced in the Northern League in the upper Midwest. So personally, it was a difficult summer for him to get through actual name-calling, physical threats to some degree, which he didn't experience in Eau Claire. But professionally, he had an even better summer in Jacksonville. I don't recall his batting average, but I think it was higher than .336, which is what he hit in Eau Claire. He hit more home runs and had physically matured a little bit over that course of that year. And really, in Jacksonville, the Braves knew for sure that he was going to be one of their future stars.
Just compare that batting average of .336 with those of maybe some other great hitters to give us some perspective on that.
You don't recall Ruth's batting averages necessarily, but I don't think he was hitting that high consistently, hitting in the 330s or 340s. He tended to hit home runs or strike out. Now, Henry, in Eau Claire, for example, in 1952, struck out, I think, it was like 10 times or something like that. You know, just a really low number. He was really a contact hitter. And, you know, when you look at his career and see 755 home runs, what most people don't know about him is he also set the major league record for total bases and RBIs. So he was just consistently hitting the ball all over the ballpark.
And when did the media start paying attention?
He played well and made it to the majors with Milwaukee then in 1954. And that was not necessarily planned. In 1954, he came to training camp with the Braves, but Bobby Thompson, of course, the guy who led the hit the shot heard around the world for Brooklyn Dodgers, was playing for the Braves at that time, broke his ankle, and they needed another outfielder that year. And so Henry sort of was the next guy in line. So they put Henry in the starting lineup in 1954. I think they knew he was going to be a star, but they didn't know necessarily that he was ready at that point. So he's all of a sudden playing for the Braves in 54, been playing well. He started off a little bit rocky at times, but within a year or two, there was no question he was going to be an everyday player for Milwaukee. And I think the media finally started noticing Henry, of course, in 57 when he hit the home run that got the Braves the pennant. And then, of course, he was in helped them win the World Series, and it was in the World Series the next year in 58 when the Braves lost. But really, from there on in, he was consistently ranking high in batting average, home runs, had even a surprising number of stolen bases. Just one of those unusual players, they said, that scouts would say could do a little bit of everything. You know, he could run, he could hit, he could throw, he could hit with power. There aren't many players who can do all of that. And he was one of those year in and year out, late 50s, early 60s, that people knew kind of like a Mickey Mantle and a Willie Mays, one of the outstanding players in baseball.
And how were his contracts looking by the time he went to work for the Milwaukee Braves?
I'm trying to remember the exact amounts, but by the late 50s, I think he was making pretty good money. Major league contracts even back then were still not, anything even close to what we see today. But they were really closer to what the average working salary was, much, much closer than they are today. Now, players are making so many, many times more than what the average American is working. Back then, players might have made two or three times the salary of an average working American. It was a good salary, but it wasn't just sort of outlandish like it is now.
And what about the term for these contracts? Still sort of almost a game by game, or has he got better tenure than he had in the minors?
Yeah, oh, definitely. You get in the majors and you've got some security. They're not going to cut you if you've had a couple of good seasons. They're not going to get rid of you if you have an 0-for-13 streak or a your batting average, goes down to 210 or something like that. They're going to hang with you because you've shown some talent and they've invested a little bit of money in you as well. Certainly when you're somebody that they've had around for a while, they're going to give you a few chances. But any professional sport, if, you're basically your career's on the line, I think any given year. If Brett Favre went out for the Packers this year and started throwing interceptions for five games in a row, somebody would say, "Hey, I think he's lost it. We can't let him lose games for us anymore."
Start saying that again.
Right. Yeah. Is there any evidence that success was starting to go to his head or affect him in terms of how he saw himself and others?
I never got that sense in reading stories about him and reading books and just seeing the person that I've interviewed a few times. I never got the sense that he had a big ego. Obviously he knew he was a great player and probably enjoyed all of the great things that went with that, but I never really thought that he seemed like he was better than anybody else. He's not a flashy person in any way. He had home runs and never pointed to the sky or thumped his chest or did any of the things that you sometimes see now with major leaguers. So I think he was just, here's a guy who came up from nothing and, just appreciated having what he had and still, I think, was never completely comfortable with all of the stardom and all of the limelight. I think eventually got used to it. But even when you saw him breaking Babe Ruth's record in 74, one of the first things he said after he hit number 715 was he just said, "I'm glad this is all over with." He was happy to get back out of the limelight a little bit. He never did like all the attention. He was just there because he loved the baseball, and it was something he did and did well.
Yeah. Can you talk about the reaction from those who really didn't want to see Babe Ruth's record broken? And how soon did they start sort of counting and being aware that he was getting up there?
It seems to me it was around 70, 69, 70, 71, somewhere in there, people started realizing that, Henry Aaron has a chance to break the record. And I don't think it ever really dawned on people because Henry never hit 50 home runs in any given season. Where now you've got guys who are doing it somewhat regularly. Bonds, of course, had a bunch of seasons there where he hit 50 or more. Then it's sort of on your mind that, this guy's hitting home runs at a rapid pace. Well, Henry had never really jumped out at people. He was hitting that many until about, 70, 71. It's like, if he stays around another 4 years, he could break the record. And it didn't hit people because Henry was never really this flashy, dramatic, big power hitter. So I think it surprised people in the early 70s when all of a sudden, you saw this guy who didn't even look like a power hitter. He's like 5'10", 195 pounds or whatever. Wasn't the prototype big slugger that you see when you think of Mickey Mantle and Babe Ruth and some of these other great power hitters.
How do you compare Hank Aaron with Babe Ruth in terms of were the seasons as long? I mean, do you have a direct comparison you can make in those home run records?
Yeah, I don't think you can necessarily compare because every era of baseball is so different. Certainly, Henry played a lot more games than Babe Ruth did to hit 715. The seasons were a little longer, 8 games longer, so he had more games. But he also played more seasons. But Babe Ruth didn't necessarily take care of himself as well physically as Henry Aaron did, so his career was shorter. So is that Henry's fault that he took care of himself better and played longer? I mean, you can't blame him for the fact he had more home runs because he was around longer.
When you quote him as saying that he was glad it was all over when he finally does break the record, is part of that he's aware of the, you know, the death threats, the racist remarks, the opposition to his success?
Well, I think that was exactly it. He had a lot of adulation at the time too. And I think people tend to focus on the negative about the death threats, but he got tons of positive fan mail. But certainly, if you get one death threat, I mean, that's going to overshadow and make you a little nervous stepping onto the field. And it sort of taint that whole, what should be a joyful process for somebody like Aaron, kind of the capping of a fabulous career. And here he's getting something that really harkens back to his youth growing up in the South. And it was just an ugly reminder of where he came from and sort of just this feeling that, wow, I never really completely escaped some of the things that happened to me when I was a kid or some of the segregation as a kid. And it had to anger him a little bit that, you know, here he'd come this far in baseball and the U.S. in general had come so far in a short time regarding civil rights, but yet here he was still battling that stigma that he was a black person. And part of the stigma was that he was the first black person to break the record of a famous white person. And I think it was sort of a crucible there that he had to fight through, that he was in a sense a Jackie Robinson, and that he was breaking this barrier, the first black player to break this barrier of breaking a white person's record.
He must have been just about 40 years old by the time he finally did that.
Would have been 40, yeah, exactly 40 years old, right.
So is that getting up there for a major league player?
You know, back then it was, yeah. Now it's, I think you're seeing players hanging on longer because they do take care of themselves better, and there's better training and just a variety of things that can extend a player's career. But back then, you didn't see that many players playing beyond 40. But part of it was Henry just had the talent. I mean, his skills weren't as good at that point, but, you know, they were still good enough to play every day in the major leagues.
And where did he progress from 1974 and breaking Babe Ruth's home run record?
Well, after the 74 season, then the Milwaukee Brewers negotiated a trade and brought him back to Milwaukee to finish his career in 75 and 76. And at that point, I think there was a little steam went out of Henry after he broke the record, and he played pretty regularly in 75, but in 76, he realized that he was pretty much at the end, that his body was starting to give out, and he did not have the physical ability to play every day at that point.
And he made the decision then to retire?
Yeah, it was late in the 76 season. I can't remember the day, but it was in August, I believe. He actually retired then, and he hit his last home run, number 755, on July 20th of 76. And in August then, he knew that. He said, I knew my body had had it. I just couldn't go out there anymore.
One of the remarks that you quote from him that surprised me was, I guess he was talking about how he would rather be remembered for his work with Big Brother, Big Sister, for his work in helping children, than for that record-setting home run.
Yeah, that surprised me too. But here's a guy who I think sees that part of his life as way behind him, and now he sees that there are more important things in the world than hitting home runs. And certainly he would say, if you can hit all the home runs that he did and then use that platform or that stardom that he gained to do something even greater, he would prefer that. He has this Chasing the Dream Foundation and works with Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and does a lot of charitable work. But he really, I think, does like see himself as someone who has taken his stardom and used it beyond baseball. And so that's one of the things that's really I admire about Hank, is he doesn't try to draw attention to himself, but I think he's really worked to do things off the field that are good and help society. So I think he's seen a lot of aspects of society through his career that he he knows and need a lot of work on.
And maybe that's one reason it's hard for people to let the title go from him to Barry Bonds, is because if you have someone who came out of nothing, who seems humble, who's done good work, and doesn't seem to be tainted by scandal, then it seems that title was sort of deserved.
Yeah, let's call him the home run king for all those years and now say he's not the king anymore. And again, the king is kind of a funny term in a sense, but I looked at him as a king in a sense, in that he was a kingly type person and that his goals were greater than baseball. And more so after his career. When he was playing, I don't know that he necessarily was hugely involved in charity. I know he did do a lot of good things, but after his career, when he had more time, he certainly put a lot of effort into doing good things for society.
It would be interesting to know what Hank Aaron would say to Barry Bonds.
I know he hasn't said much. I heard that he did send a congratulatory message to Bonds just after Bonds hit number 756.
He wasn't at the game. He had that recorded message there, yeah.
So, yeah, I'd be curious, too. He's been quiet, and that leads me to believe that he's just, again, he doesn't like necessarily being in the limelight all that much. So I think he feels it's Bonds' time and let Bonds enjoy it. But I think deep down he probably is a little bit disturbed that there's a bit of a scandal there involving breaking the record, because, again, if you had worked real hard for something and believed it was something you deserved and got it, and somebody else came along and took it maybe by a means that you didn't think were as reputable, I think it would bother you a little bit. So I would think he's a little disappointed. But the problem with the whole home run chase with Bonds is nobody knows for sure whether he took steroids or not. I mean, we all suspect he might have, but we don't know that. But that's what's been kind of spoiled the whole thing. I mean, it could have been a fun thing for America to see somebody doing all these fabulous feats on the ball field at Bonds' age. But we don't know if they're real, though.
Well, it'll keep us reading the newspapers, won't
it? Yes.
Jerry Poling has been our guest for this hour. We've been talking about Henry Aaron. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.